You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Wow, a full house. Something I like to see. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the spring season of Aloud. And I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Program and Strategic Partnership for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. I always pause sometimes. I don't know what that's about. Before we begin tonight's program, in the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library recognize and acknowledge the first peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend the respect to all indigenous peoples today. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in support of the Los Angeles Public Library. This week marks National Library Week, a time to celebrate the valuable roles that libraries, librarians, and library workers play in our communities. Your presence tonight is a fitting tribute, especially at a time when so many public and school libraries are facing unprecedented book bans, trying to curb the right to read freely. Thank you to the Library Foundation supporters and members who are here this evening. If you are not a member or supporter, I hope you will consider joining to see programs like this one and to increase critical access to information, resources, and technology to help Angelenos across Los Angeles improve their lives and to fulfill their dreams. You can support, this is like great that it's right up here. You can support by scanning the QR code. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Aaron Fox Schiff, the estate of Suzanne E. Aaron, Golden Globe Foundation, Hearst Foundation, Judith and Steve Krantz, the Los Angeles Department of Arts and Culture, Sharon Oxborough, Ralph M. Parsons, Gregory Peck Literary Foundation, and of course, all the individual Library Foundation donors and members. This spring, Aloud has expanded its footprint and scope. We have added to our already popular author series with three additional branches, Aloud and Community, which we did this morning, the first one at the Arroyo Seco branch with free glasses given to all that wanted to see the eclipse. And then we offered poetry and music. We were partnered with the Getty, and we took over a park. It was fantastic. There's also a Aloud in Review, which focuses on a book and a theme, but approaches it in a conventional format, meaning more cabaret than conversation. And finally, Aloud on Ideas, a thematic series that looks deeply at subjects in the zeitgeist. This season, we are doing a three-part series on AI. We have one on the 25th, is our second one, and it focuses on the arts. So please join us, we'd love to see you. For further information, go to lfla.org. And now, I've been waiting patiently, nattering on, for this evening's exciting program. I'm honored to introduce tonight's talented guests, the writer Tommy Orange and the actor, writer, comedian Bobby Wilson. The two will be discussing Tommy's new novel, Wandering Stars, a powerful follow-up to his award-winning debut novel, There, There. It is at once a sequel and a prequel, an eloquent indictment of the devastating long-term effects of the massacre, dislocation, and forced assimilation of Native Americans. It is also a deeply emotional tribute to the importance of family and ancestral stories, all of which help to shape and recover a sense of identity and inclusion. Wandering Stars has a multi-layered construction which uses first, second, and third person narration in its commitment to capture the perspectives of its varied cast. The shifting of the voices works beautifully, allowing the reader to be both inside and outside of its characters. Tommy tends to repeat words that deal with endurance and survival, which results in incantatory phrases that loop and curl in on themselves, as does his narrative. This novel is a collage, a mosaic of stories of history that help us to further understand the origins and the effects of transgenerational trauma that for so long few acknowledged. Tommy Orange is a graduate of the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts, an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. His first book, There, There, was selected as one of Barack Obama's books of the year, listed as a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and won the American Book Award. Bobby Dews Wilson is a Sistine Wahpeton, I'm probably mispronouncing, and forgive me, Dakota actor, writer, poet, visual artist, and comedian. He wrote on the Marvel series Echo, wrote and acted on Reservation Dogs and Rutherford Falls. He has performed on What We Do in the Shadows. Bobby is also a founding member of the Native sketch comedy group, the 1491s, and a co-writer of their critically acclaimed play, But Poor Two Knees. Please welcome Tommy Orange and Bobby Wilson. Thank you.
Good evening, Indians and other. I'm Bobby Wilson, Sistine Wahpeton, Dakota. I don't know why the lady told you guys already. So I won't go through the whole thing, but this is a library. How many natives in the house tonight? Okay, I know we're in a library. How many natives in the house tonight? Okay, studious Indians, I get it. All right. Well, thanks for coming out. I know it must have been really nerve-wracking to come into this space since none of you can read. But why? Look at the all right, my jokes are not doing great so far. This is Tommy's thing, guys. So anything that I say reflects directly on him. And that's it. Navajos. Any Navajos here? Ahoo. Oh, you went blinded, didn't you, today during the eclipse? Hope you remained in that prayerful way. That's only a joke for the Indians. The rest of you, I don't know, Google it. Navajos and eclipses. It's been a whole thing. Super excited to be here tonight. I've never done one of these things before, because I personally am illiterate, so it was really nice. I haven't read this book. The cover's really cool. Big Portishead fan, so it's super. What was it like writing sci-fi, I guess is my first question. Don't answer that. He wrote a book, and he's been doing this thing the whole time, so I want to give his vocals a little bit of a rest, because he's on a tour here. How many folks didn't read this tonight? Okay, good. Yeah, okay, a few of you admitted it. Great. Hey, you guys are brave. Hi, Etta. Sorry, my daughter's here. She's waving at me. Hi. All right, go sit down. What are you doing? Don't want to embarrass her. Don't look that way. I don't really know how to start this. Hey, you're like an old vet with this now. This is your second book, dude. Congrats. All right. Two books? I mean, with that Sand Creek thing at the beginning, this dude's not even supposed to be alive to write one book. And he did two. Unreal. I mean, what's it like?
Thank you, Bobby. I'm a long time fan of this guy, like seriously from like 2009 or 10, whenever the 1491s emerged, and for all the natives in the room who know that moment, it was monumental. And this is the last of the 1491s I've met and it sort of completes some kind of circle.
And I wanna be the very best, like no one ever. He caught them all, is what I'm getting at.
So you know, it's been different for the second book. We can talk about Portishead. I would love to hear about the origins of you knowing Portishead. The book actually came from hearing the Portishead song in a single moment, and it's not Portishead heavy at all. I don't even reference the song
not
directly.
Not
I do implicate the song. I infer that the song is in the car in a certain moment, but that's neither here nor there.
Like I said, I didn't read the book, so I didn't catch that. Yeah.
So I think I might read from the book briefly, and then we'll talk about the stuff that Bobby doesn't know about somehow.
Thank God. Tommy Orange, ladies and gentlemen, and non-gender-specific relatives.
The only thing alive. A bad thing doesn't stop happening to you just because it stops happening to you. In therapy, this is called trauma. Opal had me doing therapy twice a week, individual and group, to make sure I had the help I needed if I needed it. That was how Opal put it to me. And that I had to go. Opal was over careful about not saying that I needed therapy. Of course I needed it. But it was more like I had to go, like the way I always had to go to school and had to get good grades. Go, get. Don't give anyone an excuse to leave you behind, to not see you, to forget you're there. Opal averaged 10 miles a day on her mail route. So if anyone knew about not getting left behind, it was her. We would not let what happened be the reason I get behind in school, even though school hadn't even started yet. Opal said we would rise above what happened because bad things happening to you were opportunities, ways to find out who you were, find out what else couldn't keep you down, and were the only way you could find out how strong you really were. Opal got too positive after the powwow. It wasn't like her. She'd always been so real. Positive thinking sounds stupid. But I get it. I just hated what happened, that what happened had changed her, had changed everything. Hated it so much some days I wished the bullet had killed me. So I needed therapy. Obviously, I needed therapy. I'd gotten shot while I was dancing. But there was more I should have been to therapy about before, my whole childhood. But nobody wants to be told they need therapy, just like nobody wants to be told they got problems. Paid therapy felt better to me than some kind of free or court mandated kind, plus the therapist was supposedly native. Opal had found him on the internet. He'd said his grandmother was a full-blooded Arapaho. He looked white to me. And then sometimes not. Sometimes he seemed hella Indian, like in what he said. And the way he said it, like how what Opal said could sometimes seem to come from a long time ago, and you just knew it was some hard-won wisdom passed down to her, something simple and timeless that you would actually use in your life. I'd heard the word trauma before. Everyone knows the word trauma, but when I heard it used about me, I didn't like it. All of the work we'll be doing together will be related to your trauma response, Dr. Hoffman had said in our first session. The four Fs, he said, there are four kinds of trauma responses, two of which you've probably heard of, fight and flight, but the two other lesser known responses are freeze and fawn. Fawn? Isn't that like a deer, I said, and a yawn escaped Dr. Hoffman's mouth, which he visibly tried to suppress by putting his fist to his nose and sort of squeezing his face like it was also a fist, after which he didn't fully yawn, but did that yawn version of throwing up in your mouth. It has to do with taking care of other people's feelings and putting their feelings before your own. We will address all forms of trauma response in our healing work. I didn't think healing and work belonged together, like home and work don't. And it felt like homework thinking about doing healing work. But the healing work just ended up being art therapy, like drawing and painting and drumming and writing, learning to reframe my story with writing. Dr. Hoffman wanted me to write what he was calling an autobiography, which I told him I didn't want to write. We did physical stuff, too, meant to express or exercise my pain and emotions. Once we did a walking meditation around Lake Merritt, it felt like it took forever. Another time we went up to the hills and shot an arrow with a bow at some paper targets taped to a redwood. Calling it archery in the end wasn't enough to make it feel okay to be native and shooting a bow and arrow in the woods for therapy. But I had to admit it was kind of fun, and I wanted to be good at shooting the bow and arrow, as if it were some test I needed to pass, as if I should just know how. The craziest thing we did was called reverse speech therapy. Dr. Hoffman recorded me saying stuff in our sessions, then processed it with something he called back masking, which was just playing it in reverse from what I could tell. Dr. Hoffman said, the back-masked version was my unconscious speaking reverse simultaneously as I consciously said things forward. You're saying, wait, so what are you saying? I asked. And Dr. Hoffman laughed and coughed a cough that seemed caused by the laughter. You're saying whatever I say, some other part of me is saying another thing, but it can only be heard if I listen to it backward. Your unconscious is a powerful part of you, Dr. Hoffman said. I didn't like how he'd said powerful twice in a row like that, but also felt like Dr. Hoffman's unconscious was why he said it twice in a row like that. All humans have this ability, Dr. Hoffman cleared his throat, then pointed at his throat, saying, double speaking is natural for our vocal cords and true to the dual nature of reality. Think of all the ways the world is split in two. Night and day, sleeping and waking, life and death, good and evil, noise and silence, darkness and light. As he spoke and repeated these opposites to illustrate his point, he kept flipping his palm so it faced up and then down. The unconscious way of speaking is closer to poetry, and the conscious one is closer to prose. Yeah, but like, that's like saying everybody has some split personality. If we don't acknowledge the unconscious, which is what it wants, and we allow it to run the show, as in dreams or worse, nightmares, and we never wake up to who we are as a whole. Are you talking about being woke? I said, trying to be funny. I'm talking about seeing the mind as more than what we think we know it to be. One recorded clip had me saying, I really don't think I'm doing that bad. And then backward and back masked, it sounded like, gonna nod, might nod delirious. I didn't think it meant anything then, but later, way later, something I couldn't even see the start of then, when I was actually nodding out from too many pills, that phrase ended up messing with me, like did some part of me somehow know what was coming? Group therapy was just like talking circles with other kids who I thought probably had to be there, like they were court mandated. At least that's what their faces said, like, when's this shit gonna be over? But then maybe my face said that too. In group sessions, Dr. Hoffman would always do most of the talking before anyone else to explain why the talking mattered in talking circles, like everyone could just kumbaya their way back from trauma. It's important to voice things, to sound them out, like the way we learn to spell by slowly saying words. We have to sound out our stories. And they may come out slow and clumsy, and we may misspell them, so to speak, at first, when we first go to try, which is to say, we may misunderstand them. But as we frame and reframe them, our own stories, the ones we tell each other and tell ourselves about what happened to us and what it means in the context of our lives and the bigger life we're a part of, the better we can understand what it all means. The more sure and purposeful our steps forward will become, and the more informed our decisions will be. It's just as important for you to hear yourself speak your stories as it is for others to hear you speak them, so that you can come to know you're not alone and more the same as the person sitting next to you than you are different from them, which you never would have believed unless they opened their mouths to share their stories here in these circles. One thing I want you to understand is that your suffering does not make you special. There's a voice inside everyone who suffers that says no one else has it like this. And so much selfish action comes from listening to that voice. You're not alone, you're not special, and there's help. We have one another. Dr. Hoffman called me out on saying shit was kumbaya in one of our individual counseling sessions. I didn't even know where I got the kumbaya thing from, probably a meme. I'd complain that Native things can feel corny and fake, or like trying too hard for something that wasn't really there, that the shit was kumbaya. Dr. Hoffman had told me the word kumbaya was originally an African-American spiritual, a song that was also a prayer asking for divine intervention, asking for help in dire times, and that then the hippies in the 60s took it and sang it to mean unity amid protest. And then it got played out and became a stand-in for corniness about togetherness. Corniness about togetherness, I said back. But there's nothing corny about asking your higher power for help when you need it most, he said. Or do you think that's corny too? Are you asking me for real? I said. Let's just agree that I won't ever be asking you anything in a not real way in our sessions, okay? So yes, please answer for real. I think the higher power thing is corny, and the talking circle is corny, and crying out for help when you need it most, if I'm being honest, feels kind of corny too. Like, who's really going to help when you really need it most? God, like some great big being who's made everything's going to come around to help some little human life, like one of our little lives matter? Because what about all the good people who die every day crying out for God and God doing nothing for them? What, they don't deserve it? I appreciate your honesty, Orville. How you feel about these things is real, like you said, and everything can be useful, even corniness. Dr. Hoffman called this his approach to trauma and healing using all the buffalo, which was also super corny.
That was pretty corny, man. Reading that part of the book. Hi. Hi. Did you guys like that? Yeah. I have to admit, Orville didn't sound like that in my head. But, it's cool. Now I'm really picturing him a little bit different.
How did he sound?
He sounded a little bit more like me, when I was... If I'm being honest, man. Yeah, that's how I sounded.
That's how you sound in your head to
well,
yourself.
Well, at least in that age, when I was Orville's age, my voice would kind of sound like that. And it was court-mandated therapy. This is a personal question, but a book is a pretty personal piece of work. Did you have any of these types of, were you ever in court-mandated therapy or programming or anything like that?
No, I got into therapy later. I worked in behavioral health in nonprofit for years, so just very aware of the whole situation.
Yeah, I kind of figured. I mean, it's clearly an inside job, the whole thing. As a person who did have to go to court-mandated shit as a teenager, like that, and it also made it really easy to picture the guy. I had a guy, little ponytail. He never claimed Native or anything, which, thank God,
But a high percentage of therapists have ponytails, I feel like.
Big time. It's something we're not talking about. Finally. Yeah, man, shit. All the stuff you put Orville through, man, you're a monster. You are a goddamn monster. Made me cry a few times.
I mean, I'd sort of set the thing up with ending there in a way that, he got shot dancing. Yeah. That's, fucked up.
It's really fucked up.
And this is sort of a spoiler, but, wanting to try to see it to the end in a way that it's not so fucked up.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a spoiler. It's just to say that these two books are, they exist together, and that was the end, and that, you know, it was a 12-year process.
I really get into shit, and so sometimes, like, at the end of a thing, I may throw a book across a room, but I, well, one, I couldn't because it's like, you know, my whole family was there, and, you know, I don't want to look like a psycho, but I didn't have to. It was a really sweet way to end it, man. Yeah, no spoilers, right? Because I know that, like, maybe five of you actually read it, and the rest of you are liars. Hi, DeFaro.
Well, and to say, hey, DeFaro. To say it's sweet at the end is the opposite of it being spoiled.
I don't get it. It was nice. How about that? It was nice, okay? Clearly, I've never done one of these before. I'm really used to being like the center of attention. And all I feel is this deep resentment and Indian jealousy and hope that this successful Indian man sitting next to me fails. And hopefully I can be a part of that. Good night. Yeah. So, yeah, again, what was it like writing sci-fi? Yeah, the whole stars thing. No, man, okay, if I can actually say something a little slightly real, because I, just like Orville, get really uncomfortable, and that's my trauma response. As an Indian dude who knows a shitload about my own personal family history and all of the really fucked up stuff that they had been through. I mean, I look at every Indian and I'm like, damn, I can't believe you're here. I can't believe any of us is here. And you hear about it all the freaking time, ever since you're a little ass kid. And as an adult, I can be really jaded about hearing it time and time again. And especially as a person, I write comedy, that's my bread and butter. Reading this and following the like just putting into context how a community of Indians even exists, starting out at Sand Creek like that, I think I really needed that shit. You know, I think about it and putting all of that addiction and all of the things that we're going through now and our friends and our families are going through right now into that kind of a context. And Opal says this really, there's this really cool moment where Opal is like banging on Sean's door. And you said something in there, and I'm not going to quote it directly, but the thing that had struck me was her realizing after all this shit that she herself has been through, thinking about Sand Creek, thinking about all of the generations before her, not all of the generations, that makes it sound like it happened so long ago, because it didn't really, but how important that was in that moment for her in her place in that context. I don't know, man, it just struck me. I'm like falling apart with it right now, because it's really how I think about my own life. And I grew up in the Twin Cities. I feel like Oakland is the Twin Cities on steroids a lot of times, as far as, like, I mean, the Alcatraz, I don't want to call it occupation, but, you know, they was out there occupying for a minute. It was dope to go through that whole, it sounds fucked up, but to go through the trauma with them in their history and how they came, I don't know. I lost it, man.
No, I think
I loved it.
There's something that you're hitting on that's really important. To say it was dope, like that statement, because I've toured a lot with They're There, and with Wandering Stars even already, and all the Native people I talk to, the feeling is, this is dope. to feel and see yourself and see the stories and to understand the familial lines and the generational lines, and to feel a kind of validation around, like, this is why we feel this certain way, that other people can't know why you feel that way. And the response that from people that aren't, there's been this huge response from white people of, like, why'd you make me so sad? Like, literally, I had people ask me that actual question. Like, I designed the book around making you sad. It's like the most narcissistic question you could ask somebody. Like, I want it. Like, you know, there's this conversation around trauma porn and, like, yep, decisions to write things because it seems like the publishing world, like we see in American fiction, like the publishing world is, like, chomping at the bit for trauma stories. And part of what Reservation Dogs is doing is, like, bringing this comedy and this levity to something that has been hard to bring out of a certain kind of sad narrative that only brings about the response, like, I don't even want to hear about it. Mm-hmm. But the part that bothers me, and why I love hearing from Native people about the book, who have the feeling like this is dope, just, you know, the experience is not painful because you connect, yeah, to it and you relate to it. If it's painful and just makes you sad, that's a reflection on your experience and, like, your level of privilege and what you've had to experience in life. So to project on me, like, why'd you make me sad, is crazy. It's a crazy response to say in public. It's, maybe you can feel that at home and it's fine. But I've had it in public. People actually said, why did you write something so sad? I was in Copenhagen. And a guy was like, why did you write about such miserable lives? I was like, these are people, this is just like my family. I'm writing about, like, stuff that we don't think of ourselves as miserable. Yeah. So I think there's something really important about the outside view of us and as Native creators, like, trying to overcome it. I think a part, the impetus to I think, the 1491s and to writers for Reservation Dogs is, like, not only do we have to be excellent, we have to be smart and funny and lift out of this mire of just, like, this is a sad thing that we don't want to, the average American doesn't necessarily want to hear about it, because we're not educated on, the institution does not educate on anything but the Pilgrim situation. There's literally nothing. Unless you know somebody Native or you have a teacher who's, like, special, there's, like, nothing. And so why would you want to hear about something that makes you feel upset about being an American? You wouldn't. And people don't seek it out unless they have a personal reason to, or unless you have Native excellence and shows that are, like, you can't ignore how good they are. Mm-hmm. There was something that I heard along the way somewhere about how you'll know your people have made it, is when you have a very mediocre TV show. So that's when we'll know that we've made it. For Native representation, when we get the most mediocre Native TV show possible.
Can't wait to contribute.
We should start writing, yeah, it now.
Yeah, yeah. Might have already helped do that. Eh? Looking at my fellow TV writer in the audience. Yeah, that's so funny. I mean, I think about all the times that in my life that I've been told that I am obviously Native American, and I can't tell you how many parties I've been to where a white guy is like, hey, so fucked up what happened to you guys. So fucked up. I'm so sorry on behalf of all, you know, whatever. Some of you white guys in here right now have apologized to somebody, haven't you? On behalf of your whole race. Keep doing that. It's great. Keep doing that. We love it. And it's funny because, like, when you hear that so much, it means absolutely nothing. It means nothing. It's just the, in my head, it's the same white dude from Minnesota saying that same thing. And the reason it means nothing is because there truly is no context behind it. You take one look at any Indian, and all of this shit is there. It's all there. Everything that you talked about in this, not just the historic side, but like the contemporary side, is shit that we're all dealing with. Every Indian that I know, I can confidently say, has very close families that are dealing with addiction. And they themselves, too, a lot of times, you know? And so to just, like, see that chronicled, like, mapped out the way that you did it throughout such a span of time was, it's corny. But it was a bit healing, I feel like, for me, personally. You know.
Thank you. And you know, to talk about like doing work as being cathartic or to be art therapy, get super corny, into corny territory. But I think writing about this stuff, part of what it is, because writing is a lot of things, you know, you have to bring your whole self to do it. And so it's always a lot of things. It's not just cathartic and it's not just healing. But I can't say that it's not that. It's, you know, I'm processing things through people using my imagination. And there are real things I'm putting into it that I can't say. Like, I've been changed by the fact of writing both books, as I'm sure you've been changed by doing the work that you do and by experiencing Native people experiencing the work and, like, reacting to it, to you. Like, that's a real thing that is in the corny category and in the healing category. Unapologetically, like, I'll take healing, corny healing, whatever, like, there's a necessary piece to talking about things that people can react to and feel that hasn't been there. I mean, have you ever, whatever, to the blue corn moon, like, that's what we had growing up, cried to the blue corn moon?
Can you sing with all the voices of the mountain? Can you paint with all the... Yeah, don't fucking pretend like you don't know the song.
If we could get the whole, a certain section of the audience actually sing the lyrics.
I was really hoping.
You should try. Let's give it one more try.
Have you ever heard the wolf cry?
Nobody's willing to do it.
No, not at the library.
It implicates
too
much.
Y'all been conditioned. So have we, though. We know the fucking Pocahontas. Why do I know that song? That is actually really messed up that I know that song. Yeah,
I worked at the Native American Health Center in Oakland for 8 years. And in the dental, like, office, the waiting area, that was on repeat. So all the kids that were getting dental work, that's what we had.
Lateral oppression, is that? I don't know. I know it was an Indian playing that song. It's like,
I looked at the lyrics recently. Honestly, there's some good stuff.
It's a banger. I mean, damn. You know? Irene Bedard. Did she sing those songs? I don't know. I'm going to Google it. I left my phone backstage. Can anybody tell me if Irene Bedard actually sang that song? No, you know what? That's not what this is about.
You said Oakland was Twin Cities on steroids.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true. I think Minnesota is bigger and has culturally more going on than Oakland. the Alcatraz history is profound, and the Oakland the Oakland community is strong, but Oakland's small. Like, it's 400,000 people population, and even San Francisco is relatively small. When you go to bigger cities, you think of your place as a city, but Oakland's called the town for a reason. Like, it's relatively small, so it's, you know, there's significant history and AIM history and Alcatraz going on, but
yeah.
I got respect for the Twin Cities and
from my nation to yours. Thank you. Pidamaya. Get more tradition on them over here. Yeah. I guess, I don't know, you know, it's also like, it's not where I'm from. And I got, I've been booed twice on stage. One was the day after a mega rally. We did a free show, me, Sterling, and Mig, in Tulsa. A lot of red hats in that crowd. Yeah.
What was the premise to the rally?
Donald Trump was there the day before we were. And our show was just a free show happening at a place called the Guthrie Green.
People were just sticking around?
I mean, they just all lived. They lived there. They lived there, to be clear. We got booed there. And then in Oakland at an event called Thangs Taken. Clever, huh? Yeah. It was a Thanksgiving thing for those. I know some of you don't really get jokes, but.
But they went doubly hard at the change by saying thangs.
Thangs taken. Yeah, not thanks, guys, or giving. Now you get it? Huh? Okay, it is kind of clever. Yeah, we got booed there too, but that was Mig's fault. He told a joke about going down to the courthouse and filing a restraining order. And it was really funny. That's not the context, and I'm not going to do his joke or anything because I actually kind of don't really remember it, but I remember the boos, and I remember a hiss. I didn't know people actually did that, you know? Been chasing that high ever since, you know? Hoping to get a hiss while I'm here. You hissing me? Oh, you're telling us we don't have much time. We got to do Q&A. Got it. Yeah, I know. I could. Thank you, guys. Ooh, that's what I live for.
You got one of those good hisses.
Yeah, that was a nice one. Uh-huh. Don't raise your hand yet. Chill. Hope you're enjoying the conversation. What? No? All right. Wait, is that Cameron? Oh my God. Dude, I watched all of Snowfall. Fantastic. Made me hate the CIA that much more. Yeah. You did a great job.
I really appreciate your work. I mean, in terms of sort of the lived experience of genocide in this country and historically, but also how it twists people's lives all the way through to the present. And this is, in a sense, you make it very particular on your own community, but it is universal in so many ways. And I'm with I volunteer with the Bob Avakian Institute, and he's put out a very controversial statement, which we've gotten a lot of back and forth on, which is, when was America ever great? And it's a very important question if you ever want to fight for humanity. And I think your book is a huge contribution to answering that question. You know, I mean, the genocide, the slavery, the war. And I just wanted, you know, that question, when was America ever great? I would love you to comment on it from your.
The year was 2016. It was November, and this great man was voted into power. That was the last time, I think. No. I mean, it's an absurd thing. It's an absurd premise and a non-controversial premise for anybody who studies history in any kind of real way. It's just the way that we teach history is to make obedient, patriotic citizens who won't revolt against the government who is taking advantage of all of them. It's a non-controversial statement, unless you're one of the people invested in keeping the power and status quo as it is. So the greatness, you know, it's an absurd euphemism. America is a lot of things. To say it's great as a political figure is just, you know, it's a nothing statement.
Hi, thanks for being here tonight. It's been great listening in. Tommy, I was wondering if you could talk about your experience at IAIA and kind of how you made your way there and if it impacted your writing at all.
I went through unscathed by the experience. I'm kidding. I was very skeptical of the MFA as an institution because I would like go to bookstores and read all the new fiction coming out. And everyone on the, in their bios was coming out of some MFA. And everything, or a lot of what I read was just like very safe. And I didn't feel like there was a voice. And I felt like the MFA was the fault of that. And then I found, you know, that there was a Native-specific MFA with Native faculty and Native students, and I had a great experience there. Met a lot of great people, and it was a two-year program, and you write a book, basically, or at least you write toward a book, because it's like half a book is what the thesis allows. And, you know, it's not a perfect system, but no institutions are. And I had a good experience there, and it was like part of how my book became a book.
Died.
Was that an immediate follow-up? Or a different person, I can't tell.
Different person, you racist.
Hi. Oh, yikes. I'm halfway through Wandering Stars, and it's so good. I had to go immediately after I had read There. And I just want to say two things about everything you've said. First of all, There, I love the double entendre that I thought, ooh, I'm going to be consoled. You know, I'm a white person. I know this is from a Native American. Someone is going to be consoled by this book. There, of course, you know, Gertrude Stein. I'm offended with not only that, but the opening was like a bomb going off in my heart, the opening of There, that history. It's not like I didn't know it, but the accumulation and the pileup, it was massive. And I'm wondering, is that how you started to write that book, or did it go that way somewhere during the writing? It was shocking. It was a bomb. Thank you.
Thank you. No, I mean, I wrote the prologue alongside the stories, and it was really the premise of the prologue was like to contextualize urban Native life. Most people, including Natives, don't necessarily fully know the urban Native story and relocation and assimilation and the policies behind it before that. And so I just tried to write something that was first contextualizing the stories that I was going to go into, because it's so unfamiliar to see Native people in cities. We're literally writing against anybody writing modern Native lives already, even without the city part, is writing against hundreds of years of representation that's offensive and false. There was a council that got together that Jim Thorpe was a part of in like 1912, like, we're not that far into film history, where Native people were like, y'all aren't doing this right. In 1912, met him in 1921, doesn't matter that much. We have had, you know, we had our first TV shows, real TV shows, just recent, in 2021, Rutherford Falls and Reservation Dogs were like the first shows that were ours. And so the prologue had to do with contextualizing urban Native life, but anybody representing modern Native life now is writing against 100 years of false representation and big-nosed Italians playing our parts in films.
Indians have big noses too, though, so I get it.
Hello, I'm also halfway through Wandering Stars, and one of the things that keeps coming up is importance of reading and how one of the characters reads Frankenstein and relates. One of the characters goes to a library and asks about Native authors and is told there aren't any. Who were the authors that kind of kicked off your love of reading and writing?
I'm feeling like there's a problem with the book that like halfway through it really like starts to not work anymore. I'm a pretty atypical reader. Like, I didn't read in high school. I like briefly got down with Beowulf when he dove down deep and fought the monster. There was like a moment where I was like, this is cool. But like, I really didn't finish a book until after college. My undergrad was in sound engineering, so I was a musician and an athlete before I was a writer or a reader. So after I graduated from a sound engineering school, where I mostly recorded to analog tape, where we read notebooks, or we read like MIDI manuals. This is musical instrument digital interface. It's probably not even being used anymore. None of it's being used anymore. That was the point. I couldn't get a job out of school. Like, this was at the pivotal point where we switched to the MP3 and people stopped caring about the quality of sound and wanted the quantity of sound to put on their MP3s, on their iPods. Literally, we chose quantity over quality. And all of my sound teachers were like, no, they'll never do that. They'll never choose quantity over quality. And it was completely what happened. And obviously, with streaming music and, you know, everything being streamed now, nobody really cares about the quality of sound. So I got a job at a used bookstore after getting that degree. And the woman who hired me, like, literally wanted me to move books from one warehouse, from two warehouses into one. So she hired me to move books. Clearly, when I was being interviewed, I wasn't a reader because I hadn't finished any books. I found something in the classified.
Neither did she.
This is how old I am. Guy got a job from reading the classifieds in a newspaper. And, I was reading whatever I came across. A lot of works in translation. But I would follow publishers, like New Directions and NYRB were like really important publishers. And I was reading about sort of this global experience of human life well before I even got to the Native canon. So there was a lot of different books that influenced me along the way, but there wasn't anything definitive until I started writing about my life and until I started reading the Native canon that sort of brought everything to life. So I don't have any books to like point to. Like, Louis Erdrich was huge for me, but nothing else specific can I point to.
Is there anyone that's only read the second half? Maybe we could talk about that part.
Hi. The three of us here were all in grade 11, and we had to read There, There for, we did an Indigenous unit, and it was very impactful, I think, to all of us. It was our favorite book of the year that we read, and it definitely gave a very first-person experience to our class, which I don't think had any Native people in it, and that was very interesting. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on Indigenous education in schools and with that, like, book bannings, because it was, your book was so impactful to us and very eye-opening, and in a lot of places, books like that are being shut down. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Thank you. The book being taught in high schools has been pretty new and pretty incredible to find out about. I recently went to a school in the Bronx. There was like a feature in the New York Times, and that was super impactful. There was a more impactful moment, and my book hasn't been banned as far as I know. I went to a school in, so Oakland is broken up into North Oakland, West Oakland, and then the whole rest is East Oakland. It's huge. It's East Oakland and then deep East Oakland. There's no South Oakland. So I went to a high school in deep East Oakland, and they brought in like a local TV crew, and the kids interviewed me, and all like three different grades had read it, and this was a super powerful experience. Afterward, I'm going out to my car, and whenever I'm around high school kids, I'm super nervous and afraid. Not just because I was in deep East Oakland, it's any high school kids. Their energy is just crazy. Like your peer next to you, like his knee was going crazy when you asked the question, and it was making me feel like, there's just an energy.
There it goes again.
And so I'm almost to my car, and I see these kids coming back from like off campus lunch, and they're all together, and I'm like quickly trying to get to my car. And one of them yells out to me, he's like, "Hey!" And I turn around, and he's like, "I fuck with your book." And like that moment it was like an Oakland moment, and this like healing high school energy moment. That was great, and the teaching in schools overall has much to improve on is an understatement. But I've heard a lot of stories about teachers like making the changes to get, you know, certain books into the classroom, and that's an incredible thing, and I appreciate you sharing that and that you connected to it.
Oh, it's your choice, huh? Yeah.
Just to know, what are your future projects?
Do you know you're sitting next to Native royalty? I have a project I did with DeFerro, a short film that a lot of people don't know about. I have a feature film that is with the studio right now. It's an original screenplay, and there's being adapted for TV that I don't think I can talk about too much, but there's somebody in the crowd that knows a little bit about it. Appreciate her being here. And I have a third novel that I sold at the end of last year that's not related to these two books. That is a contemporary Oakland novel about Native life and sort of delves into the world of pretendians. So it got a little bit of a lighter tone to it. It's not, the world of pretendians is not light, but the tone of the book is.
It is a funny world, though, the pretendian
world. It's crazy.
Yeah. Shit's bananas.
It's absolutely nuts.
Oh, God, I want to do the opposite so bad.
just want to be white for like a, just like a little bit. But only for like the benefit of it, you know? I just love their culture, that's all. That's all I'm saying. Just love it.
All so much for joining us this evening.
And, thank you, Tommy. Bobby.
We'll be thank out you, in the lobby signing books.
Thank you all for coming out.
Aloud is made possible by Hearst Foundations, Golden Globes Foundation, LA County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox Schiff, the Steve and Judith Krantz Foundation, Estate of Suzanne E. Aaron, and individual Library Foundation donors and members. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library. To support programs like these, become a member at lfla.org.